just after 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and that must mean it's time again for Money Management with Opus 111 Group's Mike Mayo. Here's Mike.
Good morning. Welcome to the latest installment of Money Management. We are your antidote to conventional wisdom. My name is Mike Mayo. I'm with the Opus 111 Group, and we're all set for another hour of financial news, a recap of what's been going on in the economic world, and most importantly, how it all affects you. And I'd say that there were a few things that affected investors this past week. We're going to be generally talking about some of these bank developments in the bank sector, the Federal Reserve announcement this past week, talk about the debt ceiling, and of course, some market comments and some wrap-up comments as well. Yesterday, we had a great day in the marketplace, a great way to end the week. We had Apple reporting great earnings Thursday night, which helped get things started right off the bat. We also learned that the April jobs report showed 253,000 folks being added to the payrolls. It was only anticipated that 180 would be added. And we also saw the national unemployment rate dropping to 3.4%. That's the lowest rate since 1969, and I'm here to tell you we got a whole lot more folks working now than we did then. So let's do the data dump and see where we ended the week. The Dow closed 546 points higher at 33,674. S&P was at 4,136. NASDAQ ended at 12,235. We had the Russell 2000 finishing at $1,759. Gold settled at $2,024 an ounce. Silver at $25.59 an ounce. Crude ended at $71.34 a barrel. 10-year Treasury at 3.43%. And now soft white wheat, that was at $7.21 a bushel. You know, I think in reading over things during this week and listening to people and stuff, there's a lot of disconnect between perceptions and reality, I think, in some of these news items that have been flying around and confusing folks. And I'm going to try and help you determine which is reality and which are perhaps more perceptions. Now, on the 4th of May, which was Thursday, here's some of the headlines that were out there. Half worry that deposits aren't safe. More banks are stressed. Crisis expands. Makes you feel all warm and toasty inside, doesn't it? You know, banking is a confidence game. I'm not talking about, you know, where you're moving the pea underneath the walnut and say, where is it? No, not that kind of confidence game. It's the depositors, the customers of the banks, have to have confidence that, it's going to be there. Their money will be there and they can get at it when they need it. And no regional bank, and some of those regional banks are pretty big anymore, can survive bad news or even bad data, because then what happens is, well, their stock price drops and insured and uninsured deposits get withdrawn. And it's kind of like in showbiz, I want to spend more time with my family. Well, this one is like pursuing strategic alternatives. That means that the FDIC may be breathing over your shoulder. So those are the kinds of things that shareholders don't particularly care to hear. And you know, confidence in any financial institution is built over decades and is destroyed in days. Think back to 2008. And here we had a couple examples here in the last month or so. You know, each bank fails, the next one begins to wobble. So you got this fear of contagion risk within the bank sector, and has really, I think, helped drive the sell-off and depressed sentiment. There is no immediate, this isn't a virus. It isn't like, okay, you get a cold, I get a cold, and that bank across the street's going to get a cold. No, they're not all structured the same. And again, I'll give you some little bit of difference into that. Now, there was a recent Gallup survey that found that consumers are growing increasingly fearful about the safety of their bank deposits, like that comment I said right off the bat. According to Gallup, 48% of Americans are either very or moderately worried about their money following the bank challenges, worst bank challenges in 15 years. 20% of folks say, we're not worried at all. Now, this to me is a very interesting snapshot of sentiment because you consider that the FDIC's report on potential deposit insurance reform, which was released just this past Monday, showed, you ready for this? 99% of all U.S. bank deposits are under its normal $250,000 insurance limit. So clearly there's a disconnect between sentiment and reality. You know, all banks, regardless of size, offer their depositors FDIC insurance. So they all have the $250,000 insurance. You don't have to go to Mega Bank from Tiny Bank, where you've known everybody and worked with them forever, and just because you want to make sure you have insurance. Well, they all got it. And only about 1% of bank deposits are uninsured, which is to say over the limit. And nearly half of folks think, again, their savings are vulnerable. You know, for most people, I think you can agree that $250,000 is not exactly lunch money. That's an awful lot of money to just keep in the bank. For those who are maybe close to buying a house or need their down payment to be liquid, yeah, that makes sense. Although I would suggest that money markets are perhaps a better place to park it. Typically, like in a brokerage firm, your insurance per account is much higher. And because the money markets are considered securities, they're not considered cash. But that's a discussion for another time. Anyway, for businesses that need cash to make payroll, yeah. But beyond that, we think most people carrying over $250,000 in cash could probably benefit from taking a pretty close look at their goals and needs and whether they're positioned in the best way to get there. And personally, you know, I'm really hesitant to even call this banking situation a crisis. I know that's the hot term, but I don't feel like it. It's not at all like 2008. Many banks had issues with capital adequacy and so on, and this seems to be much more focused on certain types of banks with certain types of customer bases that are most vulnerable. Now, Bloomberg did a survey. Everybody's doing surveys. Well, Bloomberg did one that said almost half adults, again, are worried about the safety of their deposits. Levels of concern as high or higher than during the 2008 global financial crisis, unquote. Now, levels, this is interesting, or just, well, nice to know. Levels of concern are around somewhat along party lines. 55% of Republicans say they're worried, along with 36% of Democrats. I have no idea why there's that delineation, but there you go. And stress is also significantly higher, they found in the survey, for those folks who don't have a college degree and who make less than $100,000 per year. And again, even though the FDIC guarantees your deposits up to $250,000. Back in the day when SNLs were going, savings and loans were going out of business, typically what would happen is a different savings and loan would show up. You'd get new account documents, and that would be the name of that song. It was a fairly easy process. You know, you didn't have to get your money out of the bank. You didn't have to stand outside or anything like this. Now, the bank that set all this fun stuff off, the Silicon Valley Bank, you know, this is one of those certain type of bank, certain type of customer. They really benefit from the boom in private markets over these past few years. They had deposits of $61.7 billion at the end of 2019. And 2 years later, at the end of 21, $189 billion. And this is because they work primarily with high-tech and biotech startups. So there's lots of money that they were raising a year or two ago. Now, what they did with the money, I'm talking about the bank, is coming back to haunt them. They bought mortgage-backed securities, which is not bad, and treasuries before interest rates started to rise. Now, as interest rates have risen, and this is just math, it's bond math, as we like to say, the prices of the securities went down. This is true no matter whether you've got AAA paper or L-rated paper, there's no such thing, but or Z, whatever the bad kind is, tax-free, taxable, government, corporate, doesn't matter. They all work the same. As interest rates rise, the prices of existing bonds will tend to go down, and vice versa. If interest rates were to drop, the prices of existing bonds will tend to rise somewhat. And so banks are holding a number of securities which technically have losses but aren't yet realized. And that's not untypical. That doesn't make them bad. That had nothing to do with how we got into this little bit of a challenge. We're talking about the Silicon Valley Bank, the guys that basically set all this hoo-ha in motion a month or so ago. And, you know, again, they're kind of a special situation because its funding base was focused on, as I said it before the break, on techs and bio startups. You know, and okay, so that's pretty different. And so there was a lot of money in those companies getting their funding. And what did they do it? Well, they brought it to the bank to hold it for them until they needed it. Okay, so far so good. And typically, they don't worry about $250,000 insurance limits. And again, that's a conversation for another time, but that's not atypical by any stretch. But what the bank did is that they were taking in all this money, and because, as you may recall, up until about a year ago, interest rates were effectively zero. And so the bank took the bet, basically, that interest rates would stay at that level so that the spread, the difference between what they were paying for money and what they were lending it out at, was such that it was okay and, you know, just cruise control, so to speak. Well, then the Fed in its audacity started raising interest rates. And coincident with that, these startup companies were their funding was starting to slow down, has started to slow down, and so instead of just getting outside money to spend to keep their programs going, they have to go to the bank and get the money. Now, they're not going in for $25 or even $1,000. They're going in for lots of money at a time. And so the banks typically don't keep that kind of cash handy. So what do they got to do? They got to go to their portfolio, if you will, and liquidate some of the holdings just as you would to meet your bills. And that was that, except that in the interim, with the interest rates having gone up, the value of the bonds that they were holding, and again, these are not junk jewelry. This is mortgage-backed securities and U.S. Treasuries. So full faith and credit of the government behind them, no problem there in terms of the quality. It's just the bond math. And so it went down. Those assets went down in value, so they had to keep selling at a loss. Not a good thing to do. That's not really fun. And so there were some delays as more and more people were taking money out. And again, at that point, it wasn't the quote-unquote run. It was just companies needing money. And they were saying, oh, well, yeah, we'll get it to you in a little while, you know, instead of just here's a check or however they were going to do it. And they were, and so the social media got involved and let's, you know, remember like the old game you used to play called telephone, and you'd start say, you know, at one end of the table you'd say one thing, and at the kid at the other end of the table had, let's say, no exact relationship to what the original conversation was. Well, it wasn't necessarily quite that bad, but pretty close. And so they basically, they meaning the social media types, the customers, created a run on deposits. And when you're trying to meet the withdrawals and you're doing it with assets that are going down in value, that's not a winning combination, okay? So the customers of Silicon Valley Bank attempted to take out more than $140 billion over 2 days. Like I said, something more than $1,000. And because because the Fed had hiked rates 8 times over the previous 12 months, those treasuries that they bought back before had certainly seen some loss in their principal amount. So the cash burn at the company level was becoming a major issue. The bank is hemorrhaging money as they making these withdrawals. They had to sell their assets. But, you know, what happens is that when they celebrate a loss, you know, I don't want to get too confusing here, but the losses flow to the bank's balance sheet. And so the equity of the bank tends to start getting worn down, eroded, if you will. And so, once again, we got a liquidity problem because the deposit outflows put more and more pressure on the banks to sell off these assets. Now, this is a whole lot different than 15 years ago in 2008-09 in one very large way. The bad loans that were the cause of previous crises can take months to bring a bank down. The financial crisis in 08 and 09 involved mortgage-backed securities that collapsed in value from, how would I say, overheated housing values. Well, that was not the case in this instance. This was simply a function of the bond math. Now, in a related issue, J.P. Morgan assumed all of First Republic Bank's remaining $92 billion in deposits. I think that was Monday. And First Republic's shares had lost 97% from their market value was $22 billion at the start of this year and $642 million a week ago. That's not a good direction. You know, and J.P. Morgan, the person, ended the panic of 2007. He went to the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, basically, and put in his own money to keep the panic from becoming more so. And it looks as if, on a relative basis, J.P. Morgan, the corporation, may have helped do it again. Jamie Dimon, their CEO, said that their deal, taking over First Republic's deposits and so on, resolved much of the fallout in the banking sector. And he said, and I'm quoting, there are only so many banks that were offsides this way. I've never heard anybody use it that way. But anyway, there may be another smaller one, but this pretty much resolves them all. This part of the crisis is over. So this past week, we saw more small and large bank shares decline to get guilty by association more than anything else. On Thursday, shares of PacWest were down 38%. They had been down as much as 50% because they were supposedly, and again, as I alluded to earlier, assessing strategic options, including a possible sale. Well, that isn't what the traders wanted to hear. That suggested that something was awry, as we like to say. And, you know, normally the possibility of a merger might make people say, oh, that's good. But the problem with PacWest, as was with First Republic, is while on one hand, the buyer might be able to protect customer deposits, it isn't necessarily a great deal for the shareholders. That's because the sale price of the bank in question would in part reflect the current market price of its assets. And so loans made at fixed rates on its books, well, they had declined in value. And any bank that acquired PacWest or these others would have to mark these loans down, which again depresses the price the buyer would be willing to pay. Now, yesterday, J.P. Morgan, the aforementioned, put out a research note on that upgraded Western Alliance, Zions Bancorp, and Comerica to overweight. They said that these banks appear, quote, substantially mispriced, unquote, in part due to short-selling traders. So that is a very rapid synopsis of what's been going on in the banks. And again, I can't really call it a crisis because it is limited really to a few kind of specific banks. The banks that in our listening area and certainly most that I've read or come across, it's not an issue. So don't worry about it. And as the survey from the Fed said, with only 1% of folks having more than $250,000 in the bank, even if your bank went upside down, you would get your money back. Okay? So, now on Wednesday, the Fed Open Market Committee raised their interest rate, the key interest rate. It's the 10th increase. Well, again, they're aimed at battling inflation, but it's the 10th increase in just about a year. Because a year ago, again, it was just about zero. So the Fed funds rate now is between 5 and 5.25. And technically, not technically, actually, it's a 16-year high going back to 2007. But if you remember what was going on in 2007, that was some rather an aberration in terms of the economy as well in a different way. So the Fed did signal that it was ready to pause raising rates, and said that further monetary tightening, meaning higher rates, would depend on how inflation and the economy respond to sharply higher borrowing costs. Now, why the market expects rate cuts, I'm not sure. The next key inflation bit of information we're going to get will come on Wednesday when the Consumer Price Index for April is published. Thursday, we'll get the Producer Price Index for April as well. So we'll have a much better idea as to just if inflation is indeed tailing off as it would appear. Now, at the same time, the longer-term bond yields, and we're talking about longer than 10 years, have been drifting lower and stock prices have been rising. Now, that's not a tightening of quote-unquote financial conditions that some models of monetary policy watch, and we have yet to see the kind of weakness in the labor market that would get the Fed to stop hiking rates. Now, in a hint that the Feds would pause their rate increases after this move, they did cut a phrase from their previous policy statement. Now, these guys wordsmith these things to death, so I can't even imagine what those conversations must be like, but they did say in their statement they would monitor economic and financial market developments and the effects of their earlier rate increases. Now, again, this is Fed talk. In determining the extent to which additional policy firming may be appropriate to return to inflation to 2% over time. Crikey. Anyway, that's, when we might have to raise rates again. Now, Mr. Powell made it definitely clear that a pause in rates is not destiny, he said. And I'm quoting him. He said, this was on Wednesday as well, a decision on a pause was not made today. We on the Open Market Committee have a view that inflation is going to come down, not so quickly. It will take some time, and in that world, if that forecast is broadly right, it would not be appropriate to cut rates, and we won't cut rates. But they also left their, options open. You know, because even if the Fed does pause at its next meeting, which will be on the 14th of June, it shouldn't necessarily be seen as the beginning of easy monetary policy in the form of rate cuts. He says he, Mr. Powell, wants us to make no mistake. They will resume rate hikes if he thinks, well, if the committee thinks, inflation isn't cooling as hoped. And here's the threat, I guess. We are prepared to do more if greater monetary policy restraint is warranted. Now, you can't even begin to guess what the Fed's going to do until you see more data, that's for sure. And as I mentioned, the CPI coming out next week will help give us some insights as to perhaps which way their thinking may go. And, you know, bull markets often do start after a few interest rate cuts and when the economy is sluggish. So this could be very good news for investors over the coming year. Now, changing gears a bit, the debt ceiling. Boy, oh boy. Man, these guys are beating this thing to death. We're in the phase now of this DC-created melodrama that will likely lead to an appreciable increase in political posturing and crisis choreography before a deal can be reached. Now, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, last Monday, warned that the U.S. may run out of measures to pay its debt obligations earlier than the government and Wall Street had been expecting. Now, to be clear, the debt limit does not authorize new spending commitments. It simply allows the government to finance existing legal obligations that prior Congresses and presidents of both parties have made in the past. In her letter to House Speaker McCarthy, Yellen said that the new data on tax receipts had forced the department to move up its estimate of when the Treasury Department will be, quote, unable to continue to satisfy all the government's obligations, unquote. And again, she said that could potentially be as early as June 1st if Congress doesn't raise or suspend the debt limit before then. Now, a couple small addenda here about that congressional requirement. One is that based on the most recent Treasury projections, Analysts at the Bank of America are saying that the government will not run out of cash until July 28th. That's like 2 months longer than what she had suggested. The other is that I think she just flat missed the memo that explaining as of late last week, the House of Representatives, also had already voted to raise the debt ceiling. The entity that's slowing things down is the United States Senate. And I'll let you stew on that in the privacy of your own home. Anyway, is the U.S. actually going to default in the next few months? No. They're going to raise the debt ceiling. They'll borrow more money like they always do. There's no good reason other than political malpractice for us to default on our debt. Plenty of revenue is flowing in to pay interest on it. You know, and historically, not that it means anything technically, but historically, Congress has always acted when called upon to raise the debt limit. Going back to 1960, Congress has acted 78 separate times to permanently raise, temporarily extend, or revise the definition of the debt limit. Congressional leaders in both parties have long recognized that this is necessary. So, you know, this is all political posturing, this stuff about debt ceiling. And, you know, they're just trying to gain advantage. You know, those guys are terrible if they don't do this. And these guys are terrible if they do this. You know, that whole baloney. So put some cotton to your ears when they start talking about debt ceiling. Now, some general market comments. I do the, as you may know, the daily drive time market reports on KXOY about the market, what's going on and what's up, what's down. And I see many stocks are going up in price, but investors are more pessimistic than ever. You know, I get these comments, some of these things we just mentioned about the banks are also trade off into the markets. And according to some survey JP Morgan ran, less than 1% of their investors think that the S&P will be higher this year, close higher this year. Barron's has what they call a big money poll that shows of 130 money managers, they manage, you know, mutual funds and trust funds and that kind of stuff. Only 6% of their clients were bullish. Bloomberg had an article on the 18th of April that said the headline was, investors are the most bearish on stocks versus bonds since 2009. I don't get it. You know, investor allocation, this is from Bank America's Global Fund Manager Survey. Investor allocation to stocks relative to bonds has dropped to its lowest levels since 2008 and 2009 as worries. God, yeah, I love that word. As worries about recession take hold. In its most bearish survey of the year, and this is the first since the bank started getting silly, investors indicated that fears of a credit crunch had driven up bond allocations to a 10% overweight. That was the highest since March of 2009. And 63% of participants now expect a weaker economy, the most pessimistic reading since December of 2002. What are these people thinking? You know, I'm sorry. You know, I've been doing this too long. Maybe that's it. But I've been through three rather hefty bear markets, down 48, down 49, down 57 in my career. So I guess I don't get as touchy about this. But in all that time, I have never seen investors be as negative for the least reasons ever. And I think it's because, like you say, a year ago, you know, interest rates were nothing. Now they're higher. You know, ooh, inflation's here. You know, these are a lot of things that just showed up. And, of course, the leftover lockdown stuff. So I'm not saying it's usual and normal, but, you know, don't get too distraught by this stuff, folks, okay? You know, I think the current market situation is a lot like this past March when stocks were trading almost exclusively on fear and sentiment and fundamentals were nowhere to be found. According to RBC, sentiment among retail investors, that's you and me, has been almost as bad as it was during 08 and 09. And on the other hand, it's triggered what they call a reliable contrarian buy signal that points to a double-digit rally ahead. Well, they're saying that the AAII Sentiment Survey, AAII, American Association of Individual Investors, which polled individual investors on where the market is heading in the next 6 months, has indicated a level of bearishness that's close to the level seen in 2008. Lori Calvasina, she's head of U.S. equity strategy at RBC, she said, and I'm quoting, "Depressed levels of retail investor sentiment are sending a strong buy signal for U.S. stocks again." But here's the part I don't understand. What are people so angry about? Why are they so scared? No, emotions will always carry more weight than logic. We know this to be true. But the general sentiment of late, and that's, you can use that as consensus, and consensus usually is inaccurate. Anyway, the general sentiment seems to be that stocks are just bouncing sideways and just getting primed for another drop. Now, here's one that you may not have even been aware of. You know, you would think, oh, the market's terrible. I don't want to be in the market. Okay. Through yesterday, the, what was it, 5th of May, the S&P, since last October when it hit its low, is up 15%. What's that? Up. That isn't what the talking heads say. That isn't what I read on CNBC. Yeah, well, it's up 15% since the October low. And the MSCI World Index is doing even better, up around 19.3% over the same period. So don't ignore the international markets is what I'm suggesting there. But in any case, yeah, we have strong double-digit returns, returns that would look good for a full year, never mind just a little over a half a year. And this is in spite of continued rate hikes, the carrying out about recession, the still elevated but perhaps improving slowly inflation, again, the debt ceiling standoff, and, of course, the domestic bank issues. That's a lot for markets to deal with, yet deal with it they have and in a positive manner. Now, if the markets have been so resilient thus far, I don't think there's much logic in thinking these same issues would cause a major lasting drop from here, do you? To argue that point is to argue that the markets, which are famous for their efficiency, because they take in everything that's known from everybody who's participating, and are somehow completely unaware of the headlines that are running daily on virtually every major financial publication and blasted on the financial media on both sides of the Atlantic and Pacific. I think to have that viewpoint is a pretty risky one for the long-term health of your portfolio, in my occasionally humble opinion. Now, the economic data continues to confound expectations for a downturn. Private payroll numbers released this last Wednesday indicate the economy added nearly 300,000 jobs. That was about twice what they had forecasted. And as I've said previously, the April jobs report, which came out yesterday, showed that we picked up 253,000 jobs, and the unemployment rate nationally to 3.4%. It was estimated to be 3.6%, and is the lowest level since 1969. Now, average hourly earnings rose up 4.4% from a year ago, also higher than expected. So far, I haven't heard any bad news. Now, what's more, we added those jobs despite shrinking manufacturing, business services, and financial services payrolls. And although we've been pointing out that the housing market has begun to recover, adding 53,000 jobs was much more than expected. The housing market is just going gangbusters. So when you take a step back and recognize what is actually happening, operative word, versus what should happen in theory, you'll notice that stocks keep going up. Last week, here's another one I'll bet that didn't float to your consciousness because it was overwhelmed by the negative stuff. Both the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ finished last week with their highest monthly closing prices in a year. Now, these are facts. I'm not making this stuff up. You can look it up, as they say. So that gives us back-to-back quarters of 7% gains for the S&P. You know, typically, historically, we don't see that kind of gains in bear markets, yet alone three times the average quarterly returns consecutively. Now, having said that, of course, wobbles are always possible. Yay, for sure. Volatility cuts both ways, and it's kind of hard to have the good kind without the bad kind sprinkled in. But, you know, you can't make money in without volatility, because things volatile up, you see. You know, the world doesn't look perfect. It never does, and that's how bull markets climb that wall of worry. All have their fair share of negative headlines, and are waiting for the proverbial second shoe to drop. Now, as I was alluding to, I've had the dubious benefit of being in three rather significant bear markets. January 73 to October 74, the S&P was down 48%. The GDP was down 3.2%. Unemployment peaked at 9%. Gas oil prices quadrupled in 4 months and set off inflation in the double-digit numbers. From March 2000 to October 02, S&P down 49%. That one was the dot-com bubble. The Nasdaq dropped 80%. Yeah, we had a recession, and of course, September 11th. And then the most recent one was the October 2007 to March of 09, where it was down 57%. Subprime mortgages, global financial crisis, unemployment peaked at 10%. None of that is going on now. None of it. It isn't to say you can't. I mean, jeepers. You know, you get the good with the bad in this line of work. But the trend appears to me to be more to the upside than to the downside. You know, and again, in 2020, we had the bug and the never-ending lockdowns. In 2009 and 10, it was the car bankruptcies, car maker bankruptcies, and the TARP program, Troubled Asset Relief Program, and the debt crisis in Dubai. Now here we go back to 2002 and 3. That was the run-up to the Iraqi war and, you know, associated fears of what all that could mean for commodity markets and geopolitics in general. In the early 90s, I kind of touched on this earlier, it was the continued savings and loan crisis fallout. And in Europe, currency swings that would lead to the pound's devaluation. All of that weighed on sentiment, laying the groundwork for a reality to beat low expectations. It's not like we've never done this before. It doesn't make it any easier to deal with, but we've been through tough times and we've driven right on through it. Now, while we can't know that the rally is a new bull market with any certainty, the backdrop we've got sure seems to have many similarities. So take a deep breath. Do not let these headlines get to you. Do not trade on the headlines. Whether it's earnings, the ongoing political ineptitude, Fed moves, or what have you, the information about to come out merely puts numbers and confirms the reality that stocks have already lived through or long expected. You know, the consumer price index numbers, all those various and sundry studies we see, it's old news. I mean, stuff's already happened. The GDP, it's old news. You know, but the stock market is an anticipatory vehicle. It looks out. You know, it can be hard to remember that when you're looking at this news that, you know, it seems dim, but that's backward looking. But if the stocks are looking out 3 to 30 months, daily moves tend to even out. And as I said earlier, you know, we've been up, 15% since October? Kind of a stealth rally, I guess you could call it. Well, I hope you found all this helpful and informative and maybe a tad in educational. We'll be back next Saturday with more market news for you from the Opus 111 Group. I thank you very much for listening. My name is Mike Mayo. You've been listening to Money Management.
Join us again next Saturday morning at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of Money Management with Opus 111's Mike Mayo. Have a question or comment? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investing involves risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.